Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 148, A New Australia in Paraguay, Part 2. When we left off last time, the idealistic settlers of New Australia had just left the remarkably new Old Australia by boat. On the long journey to South America, they planned the different workers' bodies they would need. Farming, building, hunting, but also how bodies for administration and education would be created. And they assigned people to each. They also designed a flag, orange and red, with the Paraguayan flag in the top left corner, much as the British colonies had its flag in that same position, and with a leaf, fruit, and blossom in the middle. It wasn't long, however, before the first cracks began to appear. Now, I'm just going to say it here. This project will not result in the utopia its members imagined. There isn't much point trying to sell a suspenseful story where the ending is unknown and it looks like the colony might succeed. The problems began too early. I don't think that takes away from the story, however. The idea of their commune was, of course, pretty non-hierarchical. But as Lane had been the driving force, he was pretty much the leader. A strange argument almost saw him lose his position as early as the first part of the voyage. He had agreed to keep an eye on a young woman who was travelling alone, and when he noticed her getting close to one of the single men, he created a rule that single women were not to be alone on deck at night. The woman in question, and many others, didn't like this intervention into their liberty, and a large group of the passengers confronted him the next evening. As she was among them, defying the order, to avoid conflict, Lane argued that although he had made the rule, it had not yet come into force. He then tried to resign his leadership position, but the attendees of the meeting he called to do this refused to accept his resignation, and so he remained in charge. The rule about single women on deck was quietly forgotten. Lane seemed unable to forget, however, and withdrew to spend most of the rest of the trip in his cabin. Soon another dispute arose about cutlery, of all things. Everyone's cutlery had been pooled together for communal ownership, just like everything else, but over time some had gone missing, and there wasn't enough to go around. Lane had taken to eating in his room, and some believed that he was hoarding knives and forks. If they couldn't help but fall out over things as basic as cutlery, you can probably guess how it went when the real work started in Paraguay. Besides some bad weather when rounding the bottom of Patagonia, the trip was largely uneventful, and eventually they reached Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay. The split between supporters and opponents of Lane had hardened by this point. He went ashore and tried to prohibit anyone else from doing the same. It's not clear why. Nobody had any money. It had all been given to the project. And when some people announced that they would visit Montevideo and have a look around, he lied and said that the boatmen who were ready to ferry him to the city required paying, and communal funds would not be provided to do this. They got in the boat anyway, and discovered that the service was free. When they returned, they had somehow managed to get drunk. And you will remember that drinking was supposed to be prohibited. And so some of Lane's supporters who had stayed on board started an argument, which turned into a physical fight. Lane tried to repair the damage the next day by saying that the matter would be forgotten and nobody would be punished. He also offered anyone who wanted to go home free passage back to Australia, but nobody wanted to go. Whether it was poor leadership on the part of Lane, or disruptive rebelliousness on the part of his detractors, or a bit of both, it was already clear that Lane's grip on things had come loose. Before they'd even started, this was not a unified collection of people all working together and pulling in one direction. They transferred from the Royal Tar onto a riverboat and sailed up into the river system. At Corrientes, in the north of Argentina, Lane decided to send one of his trusted men back. His official reason for doing so was so that the man could look after the Royal Tar, sail back to Australia, and help with the organising of the next batch of settlers to be brought across. There is some speculation, however, that the real reason for sending him back to Australia was to raise some more money, so that another piece of land could be bought from the Paraguayan government. The implication of this is that Lane was already at this early stage contemplating the idea that their utopia was not big enough for both him and his detractors, and that it would effectively have to be split in two. It's a bit Judean People's Front. Soon before reaching Paraguay, the river narrowed, and they transferred to a smaller boat to take them the rest of the way. A week after they had left Montevideo, they docked at Paraguay's capital, Asunción. The way they were greeted by the locals sounds a bit like something from one of those films like The Wicker Man, where someone goes to a remote place and the isolated people there are part of some strange pagan cult or similar. One of the Australians described the group of locals staring at them from the dock as they approached, completely unresponsive to the cheers the Australians gave. Despite this, the importance of the scheme is evidenced by the presence of the country's president, its minister for colonisation, and the British consul. The Australians spent a while in Asunción getting their bearings, and within a couple of days, they heard of their first potential problem.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
A group of about 300 Guarani indigenous people had occupied the land which was to become New Australia. Rights to land based around physical possession and use, rather than on paper ownership, are generally stronger in the Spanish and Portuguese-speaking world, including in Iberia itself. In England, we have a thing called squatters' rights, where if you trespass onto a property and live in it for long enough, you can technically make a legal claim to ownership. I think it's extremely difficult in practice, however. It's very easy for the owner to evict you. In Iberia and Latin America, this is harder. It's part of the reason that all those shanty towns on the edges of cities, like the famous favelas in Rio de Janeiro, are able to exist, and in many cases, exist so long that they become legal property, and pretty much normal, established, official neighbourhoods eventually. I was talking to a friend recently who wants to buy a house in Spain. He says that if you buy a cheap house in a not-so-wealthy neighbourhood and then don't live there, it's possible that someone might occupy it and even use it to grow cannabis. He says that even in these cases, it can take a long time to get permission to physically evict the people doing this. I presume this is accurate. I have no direct knowledge of it myself. And so the existence of these Guarani people living on New Australia potentially could cause a problem. Unlike in some other countries, Paraguay, then as now, has a relatively good relationship with its indigenous people. The Guarani language has long been official, and it's widely spoken even by the non-indigenous population, rather than coming a distant second to Spanish. For a while, with the aim of fostering unity between the different peoples, there was even a law that said that it was illegal to marry someone of your own race. If you were of European ancestry, you had to marry an indigenous person, and vice versa. But that's part of another fascinating story which we'll tell another day. In this specific case, all of this meant that popular opinion, and that of the press, were in favour of the Guarani who were living on the land. And there were articles appearing in the newspapers which painted the Australians as foreigners, depriving Paraguayans of their rightful land. Again, to go back to those comparisons I made last episode, between political ideologies back then and today, you would imagine that if a left-wing project like this was to happen tomorrow, it would be extremely conscious of appearances related to moving indigenous people out of the way, in their own country, no matter what the legal land ownership situation was. In this case, Whether it was abstract, noble considerations or simple practicalities, Lane does appear to have taken this into account, and he resolved the situation by offering the Guarani compensation to move on, and we are told that they were happy to agree to this. The next thing to do was to move themselves in, but this was not a simple task. There were an awful lot of belongings which had to be taken there. A caravan of huge carts was employed to do this, and they trundled slowly on rutted and difficult dirt tracks through empty wilderness. At one point, they faced the challenge of ferrying all of this stuff across a river. Eventually, however, they got there. Although, even once they had reached their land, they had to spend some time finding the right bit of it to build their settlement. The site chosen by the men sent ahead was near a river, and it was too swampy. This made it potentially unhealthy, given the connection between marshes in this part of the world and disease. Once another site had been chosen, 7 miles away from the first, work began on building a village. The preparations and travel were over, and life in this workers' utopia could finally begin. Though much hard work was ahead of them, it was an exciting moment. They had freed themselves from the chains of a global system which exploited them. Those first few days were said to be marked by an atmosphere of excitement, with everyone pitching in to do the physical work of building the utopia's first houses. Their destiny was now in their own hands, and they could not only live fulfilling lives according to their principles, but they could set an example which others might follow. We know that the scheme had drawn the attention of the international left. Peter Kropotkin, the Russian anarchist, who to this day is among the most influential theorists of that ideology, even mentioned the project in his writing. They believed that they were about to prove that another world was possible, a fairer one in which everyone could thrive. Now, as you listen to this, I would guess that one, most of you hadn't heard of New Australia before, and two, you are more likely than not living and working within a capitalist system. From these two facts, whether a better and more utopian society is possible or not, I think we can safely deduce that New Australia did not create the shining example which its membership had hoped. As we move on to the part where we tell the story of the colony itself, we are also telling the story of why that was. Some hints of trouble have come up already, namely those internal fractures in social cohesion between Lane and his supporters, and those who did not seem to want to follow his leadership. It is, I'm afraid, these internal issues which are the most important part of this story. There were other factors, however. Two positive features relating to the external world, which were mentioned last episode, also proved to be not as positive as initially believed. And so this did make the success of the colony more difficult. We told of how one of the men sent from Australia to find land had praised Paraguay's political stability. Now, this wasn't a huge factor in the success of New Australia, but it didn't turn out to be correct either. The presidency of Juan González, the man who had approved the colony and welcomed them at Asunción's dock, was marked by a banking crisis. While he did agree to give up power at the end of his term, about 2 years after the Australians arrived, he tried to pass it to his brother-in-law. And so while the country didn't see soldiers in the street or disturbances of that kind, that president was deposed, being taken to the city's army headquarters to be pressured out of power. There had, in fact, already been an attempt to depose him 16 months before the Australians arrived, which the scout must have either not known about or chosen to ignore. And there will be a succession of political conflicts over the next 20 years, some of which were serious enough to be called civil wars. New Australia won't last long enough to be affected by most of these events, but given that the scouts said that Paraguay did not suffer coups and was politically stable, obviously this wasn't correct. Between 1904 and 1954, the country had 31 presidents, and more than half did not make it to the end of their terms. The other thing which the scout had noted was that access to the global market could be a slight problem due to the region's remoteness. However, he did manage to paint it in an optimistic light, saying that London could be reached by river and sea in 26 days, making it closer to New Australia than Old Australia. Furthermore, he said, some of what they could produce was in demand in Buenos Aires and Montevideo. Again, what he either did not realise or chose to ignore was that high taxes were levied by Argentina on all imports from Paraguay, and this would make selling goods there unviable. An article in an Australian newspaper at the time also wrote in harsh but quite funny terms that Greenland can also be reached from London in less time than Paraguay, and so can Sierra Leone. Furthermore, George Street, Sydney, can be reached from the top of the post office tower in 18 seconds, as has been proved by the poor devil who fell over and broke his bones against two scaffoldings in the descent. Yet vegetables don't grow on that stony summit all the same, and its agricultural value remains nil. Pretty witty, if harsh, words. For the most part, though, it was those internal issues which were the problem. There is a criticism of left-wing politics that holds that it's unrealistic, that human nature will not allow us to all live in harmony, put our own self-interest aside, and work towards the common good. There is also a parody of it, I hinted at earlier by mentioning the Judean People's Front, that those drawn to this type of politics are also particularly prone to arguing amongst themselves and undermining their own projects. Charitable versions of this assessment say that it is precisely because those people care so much that this is the case. Their beliefs are so sincere that of course they're going to argue about them. Can humanity ever build a just, non-hierarchical society? Are idealistic left-wing visions possible? Those are questions which I will not attempt to answer. Besides anything else, they are way too big and philosophical to examine here. I'm afraid, though, that in this specific case, that line of criticism can be made rather neatly. By the end of the year, so a few months after they'd reached New Australia, on the one hand, much had been achieved. 40 acres of land had been cleared of bush, and half of that had been planted with crops. A village had grown up, and it included a school and a blacksmith. Not yet built streets had been marked, and equally sized, generous plots had been given, and a house would stand on each. Orange trees were to be planted along them, to make those streets pleasant to walk down. On the other hand, though, some noted that certain members of the community didn't work as hard as others, causing further cracks to accompany the ones which had already developed on their journey there. Next time, we will examine them. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to do something to help out, one thing which is really useful is leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts from. It helps new people discover the show. If you've really enjoyed it and want access to an extra episode every month, it's possible to become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done one of these things. And thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent. Edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.